I want to, first of all, say how exciting it is that we are at this point where we're about to move back at least partially into in-person classes around Pesach time. I'd also like to thank Zamira and the whole OU staff for really yeoman's efforts in ensuring that we've been able to continue these classes and been able to continue to teach during what's been a very difficult time for all of us. And they really deserve, really Zamira and Rabbi Shore and the entire staff deserve a tremendous debt of gratitude for all of their efforts, David Hochhauser as well, for all of their efforts in ensuring that we've been able to do this. And it's exciting to be able to be moving back to in-person classes and to continue to Zoom at the same time as well. Good morning, everybody, and welcome back. Today, our shiur is sponsored by Deborah and Binyamin Radomsky on honor of the bar mitzvah of their son Bezalel Tzvi, which is taking place on the 14th day of Adar on Purim, which is very exciting. We wish them a mazel tov and thank you for the sponsorship. And it's wonderful to sponsor for a simcha like this. And may you see much nachas from Bezalel Tzvi for years to come. In addition, once again, I thank the anonymous sponsors who are sponsoring the shiur for the entire year as well, and we thank them. And we also dedicate our class to Refuah Shlema for all those who are ill, and in particular, I ask you to keep in mind my sister, Hanochana Bas Penina Yochevet, for a Refuah Shlema as well. All right, we're going to, this is a very exciting Shabbos that is presenting itself for our attention, particularly here in Yerushalayim. It's a Purim Meshulash in that on Shabbos, we're going to be not only reading the Parsha of Tetzaveh, but we're also going to be reading a special Maftir section dealing with Purim, and of course, a Haftorah dealing with Purim as well. And I thought that we would once again, return to this festival. It's one of my favorites because it is so easily misunderstood, and that means that there's so much important information and so many important lessons to be learned beneath the surface of what often seems to be a simple festival. We're going to open up with a question which doesn't apply this year, but its lesson does, and that is, what happens when Purim occurs during a leap year? If we turn to a section found in the Talmud, we find that there is a debate. We know, of course, that we celebrate Purim during the second month of Adar. During a leap year in the Jewish calendar, there are 2 months of Adar, and we celebrate Purim during the second. But it turns out, if you'd like a look at the Talmudic section, that this was not a foregone conclusion. Originally, there was a debate between Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel as to when Purim should be celebrated. And each of these scholars, basing their position upon words within the Megillah, offer a different opinion. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yossi suggests that Purim should be celebrated during the first month of Adar. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is the one who we hold like, and he says that we should celebrate during the second month. And if you look at the reasons that each of these scholars postulate for their position, we find something fascinating. Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yossi suggests that the reason for his position that Purim should be celebrated during the first month of Adar is actually a basic principle that applies throughout Jewish observance. And that is Ein Ma'avir Na'la Mitzvah. It's a simple principle. You don't delay the performance of a mitzvah. Given the opportunity to perform a mitzvah, you should perform it as soon as you possibly can. Ein Ma'avirin, you don't pass over a mitzvah when the opportunity is presented. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and therefore, says Rabbi Elazar ben Yossi, if we're presented with the opportunity to celebrate Purim during the first month of Adar, then that's when we should celebrate it. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, however, says, "Mesameich geula legeula adif." He says, no, as important as that principle is, there's another reason we should celebrate. There's a reason we should celebrate Purim in the second month of Adar. And that is, "Mesameich geula legeula." You should always keep the celebration of Purim in close proximity to the celebration of Pesach. The Geula of Purim should be near the Geula of Pesach, and therefore you should celebrate Purim during the second month of Adar. And this is a very strange machlokes and a very strange conclusion. One would have argued that Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi makes a lot more sense, that the principle that is so fundamental to Jewish thought should be the one that we follow. What connection is there between Purim and Pesach? These holidays are as different as they could possibly be. One of them is rabbinic, one of them is biblical, one of them speaks of a particular event taking place in a particular time in Jewish history. Pesach speaks of the overall flow of Jewish history, the first footsteps of our journey, and all of history we celebrate in the Seder until Yemos HaMashiach. Why is it that the position of Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, Mesamech Geula LeGeula Adif, is the one that wills out? We'll take this question and put it aside for now. It's an opening question, but I want to return to it at the end of the class, because we'll be able to understand the answer that I'm going to suggest a little bit better once we understand the holiday of Purim itself a little bit better. Turn to the second section on your sheets, pegging Purim as a paradigm. In order to understand Purim, and I've said this to you before, those of you who have been in my class around Purim time before, we have to first understand where Purim emerges in the historical timeline of the Jewish people. And this is a timeline we looked at. It's a very abbreviated or summarized timeline, but it's a timeline that we've looked at also when we were looking at the holiday of Hanukkah. We go through the patriarchal period, Egyptian slavery, Exodus, wandering, conquest of the land of Israel under Yehoshua, period of the Shoftim. After the period of the judges, the Shoftim, which is a period of loose confederation, you have the period of United Kingdom and the building of the first temple of Bayis Rishon. The period of the United Kingdom is a period of unity under only three kings, of course, under Shaul, David, and Shlomo. After Shlomo's death, the kingdom divides into two, into the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Israel. The kingdom of Israel is eventually exiled, bringing an end to the period of divided kingdom by Assyria. And then eventually the kingdom of Yehuda, we are descendants of the kingdom of Yehuda, the kingdom of Israel obviously disappears, the 10 tribes disappear into the mists of history, we are exiled to Babylon, and an exile that lasts roughly 70 years. At the end of the Babylonian exile, Babylon is conquered by Persia, and Cyrus the Great allows the return of Klal Yisrael to the land of Israel. And the building of the second temple begins to take place in fits and starts and stops. It is at this point when the Babylonian exile becomes changes from an exile of force to an exile of choice. Because let's remember that less than 10% of the Jews decide to return to Israel from the Babylonian exile. 80% or more than 80% remain behind in Babylon, deciding to live in an exile existence, even though they have a choice to do otherwise. It is at this point that Purim occurs. And it's almost as if HaKadosh Baruch was saying to Klal Yisrael, at this particular juncture of history, you're choosing to live in this condition. You're choosing to live in Golos. I'm going to show you what Golos is really like. And thus the Purim story becomes within our tradition a paradigm. It's a paradigmatic festival. And what I mean by that is, it is understood by us to be an example of a series of events that occurred at that time, but that are going to occur and recur and recur throughout our history until the time of the building of the third temple. That this is so, that this is how we see Purim, can be seen from the list that I have in section B here. This list is really a very abbreviated list. If you go to the Encyclopedia Judaica, you'll see a much longer list. This is a list of Purims that are specific to particular communities, and in some cases specific to particular families. And what these are occasions where that particular community, the community, the Jewish community in Cairo, the Jewish community in Rhodes, where that particular community experienced a near tragedy, was miraculously saved. And this is the same thing with the Purim of the families. Those families experienced near tragedy and were miraculously spared. And to celebrate the events that occurred to them, they established a day of celebration, which they called Purim, which they titled their own Purim. The Purim of Cairo, the Purim of Saragossa, the Purim of Vince, the Purim of Avram Danzig, the Purim of Yom Tov Limtam Heller. And these particular Purims were seen as a repetition of the kinds of events that occurred in the first global Purim that we all celebrate. So in the Jewish mind, and this is meant to be, Purim becomes the paradigm of exile existence. Purim becomes the paradigm of what it means to live in Golos, and what it means, and this is important because we're here living in Eretz Israel, what it means to live in a time when part of our people are in Golos, and when we, nonetheless, even though we're living in Israel, are part of a nation that is experiencing a Golos existence. Once we recognize Purim that way, once we recognize that Purim is this celebration, this paradigmatic celebration of what it means to live when our fate is not totally under our control, but under the control of others, then suddenly every aspect of Purim teaches us a lesson that is paradigmatic as well. Every aspect of Purim begins to teach us very, very serious lessons concerning what it means to live when we're not in control of our fate. For example, perhaps the most global lesson, Vinafochu. We have it written in, it's written in the Megillah, that phrase that now has become part of the song Mishenichnas Adar. Sometimes people sing Vinafochu, Vinafochu. What does it mean, Vinafochu? Our existence and our condition turns on a dime, Purim teaches us. Things can change instantaneously. Think of the Purim story. The first Nafochu occurs when Haman rises to power. Before that, we are living in Persian society safely and securely. According to Chazal, we are major participants in the celebration that's taking place at the beginning of the Megillah. We're in the king's palace. We're hobnobbing with the top echelons. Then Nafochu, suddenly we are facing genocide. Suddenly Haman is threatening to kill an entire people. And Ahasuerus is going right along with it. Vinafochu at the end of the Megillah, and this is where that phrase comes from. Asher yishlatu ayehudim hema besoneim. Suddenly we were down at the bottom, suddenly now we're up at the top again, and we're able to defeat our enemies. When you're living in this kind of condition, you are living a turbulent, uncertain, vulnerable existence. And one needs only look again at our own Jewish world today, as within the context of a global society, to once again see that. I mean, our papers are constantly filled. It's enough already. If I have to read another article telling me how bad it is for us to go back into the deal with Iran, we know it already. We've got it, or at least according to most commentators. Let's deal with it. But that's the point. The point is that we are facing total change. In total, it's the change that occurred at the beginning of our history when Vayakam El Chadash, a new king arose. And the rabbis say, was it a new king in Egypt, or was it the same king, Chiniskanchu Gezerosov? When we are dependent upon others, we're vulnerable. Secondly, living in this condition, we are living in a time of Hester Panim. Famous statement of the Gemara. Esther min HaTorah minayin, asks the Gemara. Where does Esther? And some of these ideas we've explored before, but we're just returning and just reviewing them to show how clearly they're embedded in Purim before we get to the second part of our class. Second, God's hidden face. Absent from the Megillah, the rabbis tell us, we should note, is God's name. We're living in a time, and we have said this before, that Purim is not only the point where the exile of choice becomes the exile of force, but it also marks the beginning of the non-prophetic era within the national period of Jewish history. God is no longer telling us what to do. The Nevi'im are gone. And now everything's up to us. No God tells Mordechai what to do. No God tells Esther what to do. Each of them basically are finding God's lessons and God's message within the context of the opportunities and the challenges that are presented to them. So too, we living at a time of Hester Panim, when we have to recognize the changes in history. We who are living here in Eretz Yisrael, we are the ones who are saying to so many others, recognize what it means for Jews to be able to live within their homeland. We take it for granted. It's so easy for us to take it for granted. What it means for us to once again be rebuilding our home. Time of Hester Panim. Nobody's telling us that. We have to recognize that this is an opportunity presented to us, and we have to build upon it. We're living, number C, in an aberrant world, not only in a turbulent world. The famous Ma'amar Chazal, which unfortunately is taken too literally by too many of our young people, and not only our young people, Amar Rava, Machayev Inish Levsume Bepuria Adlo Yoda Bein Aror Haman Levarach Mordechai. Person has to become so intoxicated that he can no longer differentiate or distinguish between blessed, between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Now, again, on a halachic level, I'm not going to discuss this. Is the Ramah and others say this doesn't mean you should become totally drunk. Some suggest that you should become just drunk enough to fall asleep and not know the difference between the two. But I'm not interested in the halachic, the practical halacha here. I'm interested in what the rabbis are trying to accomplish. Why would they say something like this? Why would the rabbis say that on Purim you should get to the point where you can no longer distinguish between blessed is Mordechai and between cursed is Haman? What are they trying to accomplish? Intoxication, as a rule, is against Jewish thought. It's against the concept of one is the Kohanim are not allowed to go into the temple intoxicated. It's clear in the Torah. Why then would this be a statement that Chazal would make? Because what Chazal wants us to understand is that when we're living in a world like this, nothing makes sense. Nothing makes sense. Clear lines, the lines in it are clear in an ordered and sensible world are no longer ordered and sensible in this world. You don't know who your friends are and you don't know who your enemies are. And those who are good are not always totally good, and those who are bad are not always totally bad. And the distinguishing line between the bad and the good can be a thin line. And therefore, you're supposed to recognize that this is the aberrant world in which you're living and how important it is to be able to see as clearly as you can. But before you can recognize how you have to see things clearly, you have to recognize the challenge of seeing things clearly in such a world. And therefore, recognizing that we're living in a world where those dividing lines are not that clear and distinguishing between friends and enemies is not always that easy. That's the world in which we live, and that's the world that we should recognize exists around us. When we're living in Golos, and when we have and even when we are living in Israel as part of a nation that has people in Golos, we're living in a fragmented nation. There's a fascinating characteristic to Purim that is unique to Purim, and that it is the only holiday where, from the outset, within Jewish observance, it's different strokes for different folks. basically, the one we know is the difference between Purim and Shushan Purim. The fact that those who live in walled cities are supposed to celebrate on a day that's different from those who live in unwalled cities. And generally, our celebrations are unifying celebrations. They're celebrations that are celebrated in unity. And yet, of course, you'll say to me, well, what about Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, the second day? The second day of Pesach, the second day of Sukkos. Those days are not elemental to the original observance of the day. They're not commanded to us. That develops because of the fact that there's a suffix in terms of observance. Purim is the only festival where, from the outset, mandated celebrations are different for different people. And the Megillah and the mission of Megillah goes even further. The mission of Megillah tells us, if you read, that Megillah nikreis b'achad asar b'shneim asar b'shlosh asar. The truth is that in the days when we lived in small towns and large cities, and people came to from the small towns to the large cities on market days, and they were unable to hear the Megillah in their own towns because no one had one or no one knew how to read one, they were able to celebrate partially Purim earlier, on the 11th of Adar. That's when they could start to hear the Megillah, or they could hear the Megillah on the 12th or the 13th, which means, again, that that people were observing aspects of Purim on different days. Why? Because we're a fragmented nation. When we're living in Golus, we're not a united people. And we need to recognize that dimension of our existence. It's so important that we do so, and therefore Purim is going to be mandated differently. And when Haman, we have to recognize, and we say this often, that we should listen to the words of our enemies, because very often they speak the truth. They tell us what they're going to do to us. We have to listen and believe them. Haman turns to Ahasuerus and describes the Jewish people of his day. Am echad mefuzar umeforad bein ha'amim. We are a nation scattered and fragmented among the nations. That is the dimension of our exile existence. And I believe that is why, when we celebrate Purim, two of the mitzvot that we celebrate at first level seem somewhat counterintuitive. It makes sense to read the Megillah. It makes sense to have a Suda. But why do we have Mishloach Manos? Why do we send gifts to each other? And why specifically is there a mitzvah of Matanos Lo'avionim on Purim? Why is it tzedakah we should give all the time? Why specifically on Purim? Because in order to counteract the fragmentation of our people, we are meant to underscore the communal institutions and the communality of our nation. And therefore, we're to send gifts to each other and strengthen the bonds that we have with our neighbors. We're to give to the poor and strengthen the communal institutions that are helping the least fortunate. These are to counteract the fragmentation that led to the potential Purim tragedy. We are to observe mitzvot that highlight and that strengthen our communal bonds. And finally, the last principle that is specific to a Golus festival and needs for us to underscore its reality is eyes and ear, hearts towards home. That no matter where we live, even if we're not as fortunate as we, you and I, are to live in this land, our existence needs to be totally and completely tied into our homeland and our home. And here you see something fascinating. Shushan Purim, the way it emerges from the Talmud almost seems to be Purim Torah. Let's understand what the Talmud says. The Mishnah says, Krachim hamukafin chomam yamos Yoshua korin bishchamish asar. The rule is that you're supposed to, if you are in a walled city, you're supposed to read on the 15th. And again, that's what's creating Purim Meshulash in our day. We're going to be reading a day early in Yerushalayim, but celebrating aspects a day late because our Purim falls on Shabbos. Shushan Purim falls on Shabbos. And the Gemara, the Talmud says that in order to celebrate and to mark that fact that Shushan celebrated and rested from the war a day later, we celebrate a day later. But then the Talmud says, okay, that's wonderful, but you know, we have to quantify this principle. At what point should a city have been walled historically to be considered a city that is walled for the celebration of Shushan Purim? And again, there's a debate. Rabbi Shua ben Karcha says that we should observe, Krochin Hamuchachim Choma should observe, like Shushan, if they were walled at the time of the Purim story. Mukafin Choma Miyamos Yehoshua. I'm sorry, Miyamos Shushan, from the time of Shushan, Miyamos Achashverosh. However, the Mishnah disagrees with that position. And the Mishnah says that we're supposed to observe from the cities that were walled from the time of Yehoshua, that had a wall at that moment of history. And the Gemara asks on this decision, why don't we hold like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha? It makes sense. If the story emerges from the time of Purim, then it should be a walled city that was walled at the time of Purim. The Gemara says, no. We should go by Yehoshua. And then the Gemara asks a very obvious question. Shushan de Kaman. Shushan was not walled at the time of Yehoshua. Shushan was built later. So the very city that serves as the origin or as the source of your principle doesn't fit into your principle. Responds the Gemara, Shani Shushan, Hoil Venasa Bohanes. Shushan's different. Shushan's an exception, even though it wasn't walled from the time of Yehoshua. Since the miracle occurred there, we'll consider it a walled city. So let's understand what the Gemara is saying. You establish a principle. You establish the parameters. You find that the source of your principle doesn't fit the parameters. And instead of changing the parameters, you say the source of your principle is an exception to the very rule that you're establishing. Like I said, it almost sounds like Purim Torah, but it's hardly so. The Gemara is being very specific. The Gemara is saying that even if you live in Englewood, New Jersey, or London, or Berlin, the way you mark your time when it comes to religious ritual, the way you mark your time when it comes to the establishment of a holiday, will be marked by the land of Israel. You're not going to mark your time Golus time. You're going to mark your time from the source of your being, which is Eretz Yisrael. And even if that means that what we have to do is establish a principle in which Shushan itself is the exception to the principle, that's what we'll do, because eyes and hearts towards home. I'm fond of telling a little story that many years ago I had the opportunity to visit with refuseniks in the Soviet Union before the fall of the Soviet Empire, during the beginning of Glasnost. And it was still, at that point, it was still, the communism was still in charge. And I was with two other rabbis, and one of them was Rabbi Yudin, Benjamin Yudin, many of you know, a dear friend, a wonderful Rav from Fairlawn, New Jersey. And Rabbi Yudin refused, throughout the time that we were in the Soviet Union, he refused to change his watch to Soviet time. Says, I'm not going to mark time by them. And he refused to change his watch. He kept time by the basis of the time that he had before. When he woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning yelling that it was 8 o'clock and we were late and we had to go, I wasn't very happy. But beyond that, it was an interesting statement. Here, when it comes to Shushan Purim, we mark it by what the situation, we define our existence, we define our cities, not by Shushan, but by Yerushalayim. So what we're suggesting is that all of these realities that are underscored in Purim are realities that are to course through our history as long as we or portions of our nation remain in exile. As long as we as a people are not in control of our destiny, all of these various different phenomena will ring true. But now we're going to go one more step. If this is so, like to suggest not only are these principles embedded in our experience, But the very cast of characters, the four major characters of the Megillah that emerge from the Purim story, are not only actual people, because we obviously believe that these events occurred, but they are also paradigms. Each one of them is paradigmatic of someone or a set of people that we will meet across history, and each of those paradigms will present its own opportunity or challenge, and they have to be recognized as such. The first of these paradigmatic characters is the easiest to identify, and that, of course, is Haman. What do we say about Haman? What do we say about his origins? We suggest that he is Haman HaAgagi. He is, the Megillah calls him Haman HaAgagi. He is the Agagite. He is a descendant of Agag, the king of Amalek, who was spared by King Shaul, by King Saul. Erroneously spared by King Saul. Now, what is the quality of an Amalekite? So let's take a look at the Megillah. Vayivez be'enov lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado, ki yidu lo es amordechai, vayivakesh homon lahashmid es kol ha-yehudim b'sher b'chomalchus achashverosh am Mordechai. So let's back up for a minute. Let's understand the events. Achashverosh has commanded those in his empire to bow down to Haman. Everyone is bowing down to Haman, and Mordechai refuses to bow down. A normal villain, a normal criminal, a normal horrible person who is faced with an individual who bows down to him will kill that individual. That's bad enough, obviously. But that's what a normal person will do. An Amalekite? An Amalekite will take the irrational jump. Mordechai's not bowing down. I'm going to kill all the Jews. That's an Amalekite. An Amalekite is someone whose irrational hatred of the Jewish people rears its ugly head over and over and over again. And basically, it is inexplicable in its dimensions. How often do we turn to each other and say, why is it that they hate us so much? Why is it that in every generation, in every opportunity, as soon as we get to a point where hatred begins to emerge in the world, it's the Jews who end up being the butt of everybody's hatred? Why is it that today, those to the extreme left and those to the extreme right are united in one thing? They hate the Jews. Why is it that now in Europe and through America too, in many ways, beginning, anti-Semitism is on the rise? There are those who suggest that after the Shoah, there was a period where we lived in a bubble, where it was unfashionable to be anti-Semitic. The world couldn't do it at that point. But the bubble's burst, bubble's gone. And now once again, here we are, and it's irrational. The statements are irrational. The congresswoman in the United States who suggests that the Jews are part of a plot to shoot laser beams from flying saucers to start the forest fires in California. That's on the right. And on the left, those who are constantly browbeating the Jewish people for not taking care in Israel of Jews, of non-Jews, when we treat our Arab citizens and when we treat Arabs in our hospitals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things are just irrational. Now, are there things we could do better? Of course there are things we could do better. Do we sometimes make mistakes? Of course we do. But the irrational hatred of the Jewish people, that's Amalek. And the Torah tells us that. How does the Torah introduce Amalek to Jewish history? Asher karcha baderech is the description. Karcha, the word karcha is a very strange word. Pashut Pshat, it comes from the word Mikre. They happened upon you on the way. You weren't crossing their border. You weren't threatening them. Happened to meet you, and their initial response is to attack you. That's Amalek, the first paradigmatic character of the Megillah. Let's go to the opposite extreme. Let's take a look at Mordechai. Mordechai is, of course, the paradigm of the Jewish hero. He is the paradigm of the individual who stands and faces evil with strength and with courage and fights against it. But once again, as with every aspect of Purim, it's much more complicated than it seems. Read the Megillah. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech korim u'mishtachavim lo Haman. All the people, all the officers are bowing to Haman, ki kein siva lo ha-melech, because thus were they commanded to by the king. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachve. And Mordechai refuses to bow down. Now wait a minute. According to Jewish law, and if again we were face to face, I would throw this question out to you and you would answer me. According to Jewish law, if a king of the society in which I live mandates that I'm supposed to bow down to someone, what's the law? What's the rule? The rule is you bow down. The rule is you listen to the king. The concept of dino de malchusa, dino, which is primarily an economic concept, is nonetheless rooted in this as well. You follow the rules. You listen to the king. Governments, the statements within Chazal, have a mespalel b'shlomo shel malchus, pray for the benefit of the government, because without that government, things would be worse. We'd be living without rules. We'd be living in the Wild West. So Mordechai is making a decision that at face value seems non-halachic. Why isn't he bowing down to Haman? This is not Shmuel Golden's question. It's a question that's asked in the Talmud. Why doesn't Mordechai bow down to Haman? And the Talmud gives a fascinating answer. The Talmud says that Haman had Avodah Zorah tied around his neck. He wore an amulet or something that was in and of itself Avodah Zorah, and Mordechai felt that if he was bowing down to Haman, he was bowing down to the idolatry. And I would suggest that we take this figuratively, not literally necessarily. What the Gemara is saying is that Mordechai sees in Haman, as part of his being, something to which Mordechai cannot bow. He sees that as the red line. He recognizes that as much that even though it will endanger me and, as it turns out, endanger my people, you can't bow down to someone like Haman. And even though the king says to do so, that's a red line you don't cross. And if you cross it, then you reach the point of no return. And thus Mordechai emerges not just as the Jewish leader, but is the man who is able to distinguish the red lines, which it's not always easy to do. To be able to say, Ad kan, this I can accept of the society around me, this I can't, this will be part of who I am, this will not be. And Mordechai makes those difficult decisions, and those difficult decisions can endanger you. And what Mordechai is basically saying across the years is, better to be endangered by the enmity of Haman than to be endangered by the embrace of Haman. Even though this places me in a terrible position, nonetheless, I will not bow down because that is more dangerous for me and for my people. Esther. So Mordechai, to review, emerges as the paradigm of Jewish leadership that is able to determine, to recognize what the red lines of our existence are. Esther is a very, very sobering paradigm. Esther is a paradigm of martyrs across Jewish history, of those who have to give up the most for Jewish existence and for Jewish life. And I want to be clear here, because someone corrected me when I was discussing this with them. I don't want it to appear that I'm suggesting that Esther is someone who is a martyr who is only a martyr who is acted upon. Esther is a martyr who decides that the way in which she is to contribute to Judaism will be through her own sacrifice. And let's understand how complex this is. The Gemara asks very serious questions about Esther's behavior initially. Why is it that she's allowed to go to the king's palace and participate in sexually immoral acts? Why is she allowed to become a concubine in the king's palace? And the Gemara offers a variety of reasons, most of which suggest that she is an unwilling participant at that point. But there is one point in the Megillah where a tear should enter our eyes. And that is when she responds to Mordechai's request to go to the king. After initially saying she can't go, she then agrees to go. And she says, Lech kenoch, says kol ha-yudim ha-nimsoim b'shushan, go bring all the Jews who are living in Shushan, let them fast for me and pray for my welfare. And then she ends with one phrase, and I will go to the king, v'cha asher avadeti, avadeti. And as I will be lost, I will be lost. And Chazal say in the Gemara, what does this phrase mean? She is turning to Mordechai and she is saying, once I decide to go to the king of my own volition and at my own initiative, and again, let's not whitewash this story. The decision to go to the king means the decision to go to the king and to let the king do with you and for whatever it is the king wants to do with his concubines. When I make that decision, she says, Ka'asher avadati, avadati, says the Talmud, I will be lost to you and lost to my people forever. I'm crossing my red line. And let's recognize that she, at that point, is deciding to give her life for her people. And when all the Jews are outside celebrating their victory on Purim and Shushan Purim, where is Esther? Esther is in the palace. She becomes Persian. Her children become Persian. Her son, according to Chazal, is the one who allows the rebuilding of the temple to resume. So obviously she teaches him well, and the contribution she makes to Jewish thought and idea is indelible. But she and her family, on a personal level, are lost. And thus Esther emerges as the example of all of those who gave their lives throughout Jewish history for their people. Martyrdom by choice. Ahasuerus is my favorite. Ahasuerus is my favorite not because he's my favorite person. Chas v'shalom. You'll soon see in many ways I consider him as bad or maybe worse than Haman. But because the way he emerges in the Megillah is again beneath the surface, and we have to see him for who he is. The paradigm of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, we as children learned, was a simpleton, a tipesh. That's how we dress up Ahasuerus, the fool. Everybody acts upon Ahasuerus. Everybody manipulates this king. But if you look in the Talmud, first of all, you find that he's far from a tipesh, that he actually is a usurper of the throne. He manages to rebel against the in Persia and become the king. In addition, what we recognize, what we see in Ahasuerus is the following. The rabbis say, actually the rabbis debate, is he a pikeach or a tipesh? Is he a fool, one position says, or a pikeach? Is he cunning? Is he sly? And my understanding of Ahasuerus is that he is a pikeach who makes himself a tipesh. He is cunningly ignorant. What do I mean by that? Ahasuerus, and we said this about Paro, and we encountered Paro. Ahasuerus is the ultimate paradigm. Only cares about one. What occurs to him and what occurs within the palace. What occurs outside his walls, he is blessedly ignorant of, not ignorant of, he chooses to ignore. Difference between being ignorant and choosing to ignore. I just realized they come from the same root. He's ignoring. Let's take a look. Take a look at the Megillah again, at the actual descriptions that emerge about this king. Haratzim yatsu dechufim ledvar ha-melech. Vados nitna b'shushan habiro. The messengers go out with the news that Haman has received an agreement from the king. And what is this agreement? What is this agreement? This agreement is that months from now, the non-Jewish citizenry of my kingdom can kill the Jews. Now, v'haman v'amelech v'haman yashu lishtos v'ir shushan navocho. Haman and the king sit down to drink. They have a party. And outside the palace walls, the place is going crazy. Not just the Jews. Ha'ir shushan navocho. Why? Imagine for a moment you're living in a society where you're being told that months from now you can kill your neighbor. How do I live tomorrow? I'm going to pass that neighbor in the street. Can I knock on their door and ask them for a cup of coffee? Can I borrow some salt? Can I borrow some butter? What? How do I deal with the people? How? If I'm a Jew, how do I deal with my non-Jewish neighbors? If I'm a non-Jew, how do I deal with the Jews? This is crazy. For that period of time, how are we going to live? Haman and Amalek, Yashu Lishtos, they're having a party and everyone else is astonished. Let's go on. Mordechai is dressed in sackcloth. He hears the edict. He is screaming and yelling in the streets. Vayavo lifnei ad lifnei shar hamelech. He comes to the gate of the king of the palace. Ki ein lavo el shar hamelech bilvushsak. Because you cannot go into the palace in sackcloth. Why not? Well, one would argue, you can't dress that way in the palace. But it's deeper than that. The king doesn't want to know your problem. You are an issue. You're in mourning. You've got an issue. Keep it outside the palace. This here in the palace, we have parties. We don't dress in sackcloth. We don't want to know. There were benevolent kings throughout history who had audiences with their subjects to bring the problem to the king. The king doesn't want to know. Keep going. Something we know very clearly from Esther's response to Mordechai. She says, I can't go see the king. Why can't I go see the king? Because it's an edict. Anyone who shows up in front of the king that he did not summon, you kill him. Oh, wait a minute. I'm an advisor to the king. I want to have an appointment with the king. I can't just knock on his door and go in. No, you can't. He'll kill you. It would be wonderful to wake up in the morning and say, okay, well, today, not during COVID, we're all inside, but wake up in the morning and say, okay, today I only want to see these people. I don't want to meet anyone else. I don't want to see anyone else. If I see anyone else, they don't exist. They're not there. What kind of rule is that? You go, the queen goes to see the king, and if he doesn't want to see her, he didn't summon her, he'll kill her. Keep going. The king is living in a fantasy world. The king is living in a world of his own creation where he is keeping at bay. He is keeping at bay everything that would in any way threaten his festive fairy tale existence, which is now what happens to kings like that. What happens to people like that when they're trying to maintain that? It becomes more difficult and they become paranoid. You wake up in the middle of the night. What do? Balailahu nanadosh nasa melech. What does he do? He has you read him bedtime stories. He wakes up in the middle of the night. Why is he waking up in the middle of the night? Because you're paranoid. You see enemies at every gate. And therefore, the more you try to maintain that existence, that unreal existence within the palace, keeping everything else at bay, the more difficult it becomes, the more you become paranoid. You've got to have people read your stories when you wake up at night. Keep going. But here, it is at the end of the Megillah that Ahasuerus's true evil emerges in its totality. Let's go to the scene where Esther unveils Haman for who he is. Esther turns to the king in the second party and she says, Ish Sarva Oyev, who's the person who's threatening me and my people? Haman, this Haman who's sitting here with us. What's the king's first reaction? King's first reaction when Esther says, points to Haman and says, this is the villain. King's first reaction is in the Megillah, read it. King says, Hamelech kom b'chamaso mimishtei hayayin el gitan ginas habiton. The king runs out of the room. He runs out of the room. Picture the scene. What's he running out of the room for? Because this is horrible. This is his worst nightmare. The outside world has now encroached on his existence. The things that he's planned to keep outside the gate, sure, he knows what's going to happen to the Jews, but that wasn't going to affect him. It's affecting his own queen. Haman, meanwhile, falls on the bed in which Esther is sitting and begs for his life. The king comes back in, and what does he say to Haman? Hagam lichbo shesamal ko imi babayis. His king turns and says, are you trying to seduce the queen? Oh, ho, ho, ho. Wait a minute. I know, you know, we keep reading all of these stories about all of these guys who take advantage of women, but am I to assume that the king believes at this point that Haman is trying to seduce Esther? Why is the king turning it into that? Because the king is rewriting the script. He can deal with a Haman trying to seduce Esther. That gives him an easy solution. Kill Haman. Forget what Esther is complaining about. Forget what's happening to her people. That doesn't matter. That's outside the palace. Haman is threatening me. What do I do if Haman's threatening me and I'm Ahasuerus? I kill Haman. And as far as he's concerned, when I do that, when he does that, the problem is over. And Hamas Hamelech Shachacha, they hang Haman. Vachamas Hamelech Shachacha, everything's fine now. We got rid of the problem. And Esther has to come. Vatosef Esther. She cries. Wait a minute. As far as Ahasuerus, it's done. And she has to beg him. She has to say to him, you haven't dealt with the problem. You have to save my people. And here is where Ahasuerus's true evil emerges. What does Ahasuerus do? Ahasuerus says, I can't withdraw the edict. But I'll tell you what I'll do, Esther and Mordechai. I'll issue a second edict. The Jews can defend themselves. Oh, sounds simple. But let's understand the reality. The king is mandating civil war in the streets of his kingdom. The king is basically saying, a pox on both your houses. As long as you don't cross the threshold of this palace, go kill yourselves. Go ahead. It doesn't touch me. And if it doesn't touch me, it's not my problem. That's Ahasuerus. If Haman is Hitler, Yamach Shemo, Ahasuerus is the world that allows a Hitler to exist. Ahasuerus is the world that says it's not my problem. Ahasuerus creates the environment in which a Hitler can flourish. A king who is supposed to be responsible for the safety of his citizenry mandates civil war in the streets of his city to allow it to occur as long as it doesn't touch him. And this brings us to a closing frightening reality. What happens when you live in this kind of world? What happens when you live in a world, as we said, where all of those original phenomena that occur that when you're not in control? What happens when you live in an Ahasuerus world, in a world where Haman can flourish? When Mordechai comes and asks Esther, go see the king. And she says, I can't, because he'll kill me. What is the first argument that Mordechai brings? He doesn't say you have to, you must. This is perhaps the most frightening moment in the Megillah. He says, Al tadami ben nafsheich lihimaleit mi beis hayit melech mikol hayehudim. Esther, don't think you're safe. That's how he starts. And then and only then he says, you have to stand up because you have to stand up for your people. This has always struck me. What I believe Mordechai is saying is that he is afraid that living in the palace of Ahasuerus, Esther herself has begun to change, has become to become not the victim, but a perpetrator. Chas v'shalom. And Esther then proves him wrong. Please understand, Esther then proves him totally wrong by becoming the heroine that she becomes. The point is that when you live in a world of Ahasuerus, when you live in this time, there are two possible things you have to be afraid of. You have to be afraid of becoming the victim, and you have to be afraid that the world will change you. And that you have to fight against. You have to retain, and that's one of the things that I would say continues to exist, even not only for those living in Galus, but those Jews such as ourselves living in Eretz Yisrael. We have to be a nation that is different than other nations. We can't become like them. Living in the community of nations, we have to have the high moral ground. Somehow, we have to succeed in ensuring our safety. At the same time, we have to be a light to others as to what a moral nation can be. And Baruch Hashem, in so many ways, we do so, but we must continue to do so and not allow ourselves to be changed. I once again remind you of that famous story by Elie Wiesel, and I know I'm going over time, so bear with me, where Elie Wiesel says that the just man comes to Sodom, and he's screaming and yelling for years to try to change the people, and after 30 years, a young child comes to him and says, listen, old man, you've been screaming for 30 years trying to change them. Why are you still screaming? Why don't you give up? And the just man turns to the child and says, Elie Wiesel suggests, the just man turns and says, when I came here, I was trying and screaming because I thought I could change them. Now I'm screaming to ensure that they're not changing me. And that's the gun. Those are the dangers of living in this kind of existence. And now we'll return to our opening question, which I'll bet you some of you forgot. Our opening question will be to Pesach. Because now understanding what Purim represents, this paradigmatic festival that speaks to the challenges that will occur over and over again in our history. What the rabbis are saying, I believe, is that every generation, every Purim has to be seen in the shadow of Pesach. Every Purim has to be experienced in close proximity to Pesach to remind us that our own existence and that our own story and that our own challenges are part and parcel of the unfolding saga of Jewish challenges as within the context of that framework. That's when you can succeed and ensure your own safety and salvation as a people and can make a contribution as a generation to the total tapestry of our people's history. We have to be able to recognize that what we experience is not unique. Purim teaches us it is the paradigm that these events have occurred over and over and over again. Our challenge is in the shadow of Pesach. We have to see our story as part and parcel of the unfolding story of the Jewish people. And that is why Purim and Pesach are always to be in close proximity one to the other within the calendar. Right, so when we celebrate this year our Purim Mishulash, let's recognize the serious lessons, sobering lessons that emerge from this very, very significant festival. And let's learn and let's retain our ability to survive. Times tries to beat us down, but not only survive, but to thrive as a people that sets an example for others as well.